from 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org. This is Take Two. I'm A. Martinez. Thanks for being with us today. As part of our continuing coverage of this year's election, we want to take a look at three ballot propositions relating to criminal justice. Two would continue efforts to reform the system. A third would roll back reforms previously approved by voters. KPCC's Frank Stoltz is here with us to talk about all these measures. All right, Frank, so let's first talk about the context. While these measures come in a year of intense national debate about policing and more broadly criminal justice, the criminal justice system, this debate about reform has been building for years. So why now?
Probably because for decades, law enforcement groups have outgunned reformers. Now, as more and more people understand the failings of the criminal justice system, reformers are more on equal ground with law enforcement. And they're looking to further push their agenda of making the system less punitive with an eye toward ending mass incarceration of Black and brown men. Law enforcement, on the other hand, believes these efforts have increased crime and they want, at least partially, to roll back the reforms.
All right, so let's take a look at one measure designed to reverse recent reforms. What would it do? It's Proposition 20, right?
Yeah, so Prop 20 would reverse parts of the landmark Prop 47 by giving prosecutors the ability to once again charge low-level crimes as felonies, in particular those involving petty theft. It also creates two new crimes, one called organized retail crime aimed at repeat shoplifters. That's why big stores like Kroger and Albertsons support it. It reverses Prop 57 to some extent by making it harder for people to make parole. And significantly, it would require people convicted of certain misdemeanors, including shoplifting, check fraud, and even simple drug possession, to place their DNA in the state database.
Right, you mentioned the main argument behind this measure is that crime has increased. Has it actually increased?
Yeah, one study found a 9% increase in larceny, mostly auto break-ins and shoplifting in the 2 years after Prop 47 passed. But another study found no connection between any uptick in crime and 47. And I should point out, overall, crime remains at historic lows in California and in Los Angeles. Opponents of Prop 20, including the Democratic Party, ACLU, and even Crime Victims for Safety and Justice, say that we should quit extending prison time and jail terms and start providing more rehabilitation, which they argue is less expensive and more effective in lowering crime than locking people up. Here's former Governor Jerry Brown. He appeared in one ad against Prop 20.
Hi, I'm Jerry Brown. I know a scam when I see it. Proposition 20 is a scam, a prison spending scam. Vote no on 20.
So to be clear, if Prop 20 does pass, it will be a big win for law enforcement and a significant setback to the criminal justice reform movement in California.
All right, so let's now take a look at another ballot measure dealing with criminal justice, Prop 25. It deals with ending the cash bail system. Tell us about Prop 25.
Well, as you know, it takes cash to get out of jail. A rich guy like you can just fork it out, boom, you're out the next day. Some have to go to a bail bondsman, as we know, but many are poor and they have to stay in jail until their trial or a plea deal, even if they committed a very minor offense. So last year, the state legislature replaced cash bail with a system where people who were arrested would be released based on their threat to the community.
Now, so why then is Prop 25 on the ballot?
Well, that's the $64,000 question or $25,000 question. It's mostly the bail bonds industry play to keep cash bail. It's their lifeblood. Here's the twist. With the Democratic Party and progressive stalwarts like Congresswoman Karen Bass supporting ending cash bail, the ACLU of Southern California and state NAACP say they want to end cash bail, but that the state's current plan fails to address racial bias in the risk assessment tools that would be used to determine when to let somebody out of jail. One anti-Prop 25 ad features state NAACP President Alice Huffman.
Prop 25 replaces bail with computer algorithms. Academic studies show that these algorithms are biased. Some call them black boxes.
So a strange bedfellows here with the state NAACP and ACLU on the same side as the bail bonds industry opposing Prop 25. And the final twist, the bail bonds industry worded Prop 25 so that a yes vote ends cash bail and a no vote restores cash bail for the bail bonds industry.
Yeah, this thing has been very twisty. So we're glad that we're kind of talking about it and trying to untwist it. All right, let's move on to the third and the final major criminal justice issue, and that's Measure J on the LA County ballot. This grew directly out of the George Floyd protests, right?
Yeah, I mean, this may be the most interesting measure because it is so local. It did indeed grow out of the Floyd protest movement this summer. And what it would do is it would amend the county charter to require that no less than 10% of the general fund be given to community programs and alternatives to incarceration, such as job training, substance abuse, youth development. You get the idea. This could amount to hundreds of millions of dollars shifting to those programs.
Now, does the measure indicate what factors will go into deciding how that money will be allocated every year?
Well, it'll be up to the Board of Supervisors, and the money could go to social service or must go to social services that are aimed at helping people stay out of jail and community programs. There's already a substantial tectonic movement, really, in how the county is spending its money. The Alternatives to Incarceration Plan has been funded with $70 million. That's a very important program that's new. This would augment that. Interestingly, four of the five Board of Supervisors support tying their budget hands. Perhaps they know the political winds here. Black Lives Matter co-founder Patrice Cullors is a big supporter of this. I think she helped write it. The one supervisor who opposes it is Supervisor Catherine Barger. She worries that in a time of reduced revenues from COVID, it's a bad idea to tie up the budget for anything.
I should say Catherine Barger's the lone Republican on the Board of Supervisors, but does she have a point?
Well, to an extent, you know, maximum flexibility is a good idea when you're, you know, trying to manage things in tough times. But remember, though, this is a percentage, not a hard amount. So it's 10%, and it doesn't touch stuff that is dedicated funds to things like social services. Sheriff Alex Villanueva, the powerful deputies union, and DA Jackie Lacey also oppose this. So law enforcement is against this. They worry that their budgets might shrink as a result, and they may very well. For activists, that's kind of the idea, right? Defund law enforcement a little bit and move it to people for, you know, other programs. The head of the Deputy District Attorneys Union, Michelle Hennessy, was perhaps the most pointed in her criticism. She called the measure a knee-jerk reaction to the recent civic unrest. So Measure J may be the biggest test of voters' appetite for criminal justice reform in LA on the ballot. The other big test, of course, being the DA's race, but that's another story.
Really quick, Frank, your line dipped out a second. It's a percentage of the general fund, right? Not a hard amount.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. That's KPCC's Frank Stoltz. Frank, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
From 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, this is Take Two. I'm Amy Martinez. More than a quarter of a million K through 12 students in California experienced homelessness during the 2018-2019 school year, a number that could fill Dodger Stadium five times over. Those findings are in a new UCLA report, which also looked at the number of state and community college students who are also homeless. Here to talk about the issue and discuss what can be done is Dr. Joseph Bishop, director of UCLA's Center for the Transformation of Schools and lead author of the report. Dr. Bishop, before we get into the data, how did you conduct this research and when?
We started this study about a year and a half ago. We interviewed over 150 stakeholders over that time span, including students, educators, administrators, homeless liaisons who work directly with students, higher education officials, early education leaders, and really wanted to provide a really comprehensive idea of what's happening in the field and what can we do about this growing crisis in our state. And we also looked at state data from the California Department of Education and mapped out across all 58 counties just how severe this issue is. And we were surprised.
So a year and a half ago, so well before COVID-19. And when it comes to that map you developed for all 58 counties, what kind of breakdowns were in that map?
So we broke down by county looking at school suspension rates, chronic absenteeism rates, graduation rates, and college readiness rates for UC and CSU. We also looked at these issues by race, and what we found that overwhelmingly students of color not only are more likely to experience homelessness, but also tend to have poor educational outcomes. And that's also the case here in Los Angeles County, where 66,000 students experience homelessness. And that's according to numbers from the 2018-19 school year. And with record unemployment for our state, we're expecting these numbers to go up.
Can you give us a general breakdown when it comes to the students, say K through 12, community college students, Cal States, and UCs?
Approximately 270,000 students are experiencing homelessness in our state. We could fill Dodger Stadium almost five times with a capacity of 56,000 people. Also, as we think about higher education, one in five community college students in our state, one in 10 CSU students, and one in 20 UC students. And as we look at the racial breakdown, Latino students represent the majority of students experiencing homelessness, so 7 out of 10. And also for Black students, we have 5% of students in our K-12 students, but they represent 9% of those who are homeless. And these racial realities are not just unique to LA County, but we see this across the state.
I mentioned that these findings document student homelessness before COVID-19. What might that reality look like today amid the coronavirus pandemic?
I think it goes back to some pre-COVID challenges that we had. We don't have enough staffing, homeless liaisons, and people committed to this issue, to our young people, to actually identify students. We found that 2 out of 3 students who are experiencing homelessness in our state are attending a school with no federal money. So we have $10 million from the federal government, and that's supposed to spread across 270,000 students. And we also heard from students themselves, that in many instances, students feel overlooked or misunderstood in school systems, and teachers, administrators, homeless liaisons may not know that students are homeless, and students themselves may not identify as homeless. And there's different definitions, which is creating confusion in the field. So although we came up, we landed on the number 270,000 based on what the California Department of Education shares. But at the end of the day, we think that number is actually much, much higher if we had more people to count students and if more people knew the federal law or even definition around homelessness.
What are those definitions and how can that be an obstacle?
There are two main definitions. One, the McKinney-Vento Act, which is a federal law which essentially states that if students are doubled up or unsheltered, they're eligible. The Housing Urban Development federal definition is a little bit more narrow in scope, and it doesn't allow for as much flexibility around the definition of homelessness. But the challenge is some federal money is attached to the Housing Urban Development definition. Some is attached to the McKinney-Vento Assistance Act definition. So in the field, there's often confusion on, well, is a student eligible? So we might have eligible students who don't know they're eligible, who might be eligible under one definition and not for another. So it's creating more confusion. And we heard that over and over in our interviews that we need a common definition. And we need not only a common definition, but better understanding of who's eligible and how do we ultimately get services and support to our students?
Talking to Dr. Joseph Bishop, director of UCLA Center for the Transformation of Schools, about his report on the large number of homeless students in California. Doctor, you mentioned how a lot of these schools do not have federal funding or not have federal help. What are some of the other driving factors behind the amount of students experiencing homelessness? The report mentions the number has risen nearly 50% in the last decade.
We think the state of the economy is clearly a driving factor. We know the cost or lack of affordable housing is a driving factor. And we heard from students that a traumatic life event, a death in the family, medical issues, in many instances will send families down a path that they didn't expect, to be doubled up in housing with family or friends, or just trying to find a, even sleeping in cars, trying to find a safe place to be and to learn for students. So there are a number of factors, but again, what we learned is there's really a tidal wave of factors that also leads us to think about solutions that no one system, be at the local, state, or federal level, can take full responsibility. Everybody collectively from the public and private sector has to be committed to supporting students experiencing homelessness and preventing the factors so our numbers don't keep increasing.
So on those solutions, I mean, what specific groups maybe can be part of this solution? Does school administrations have to take a more active role? Or if the money isn't there, I mean, what could they do? Is that kind of where we all right now, stuck in a way?
Resources historically have been a huge issue. And I mentioned the fact that this federal government provides $10 million a year for 270,000 students. You know, that's 1,000 school districts, 58 counties. That's inadequate funding. But also, we don't have any dedicated state money. Los Angeles County, though, is doing some really powerful things across cities, across agencies, but we need to do more. Too much of the burden has fallen on homeless liaisons or almost superhuman folks in communities and nonprofits who are invested in families, but in some instances are trying to have such a caseload that they can't support everybody. So we need more public-private partnerships. We need lawmakers making this a priority much more deliberately. There is a stigma around homelessness that it's an adult issue, and we often overlook young people as part of that. But the education system, the public health system, the housing system, we need to do a much, much better job of coordinating and prioritizing resources. But at the end of the day, lawmakers have to prioritize students experiencing homelessness in our budgets. And as voters, you know, ask our lawmakers to support our students and shine a light on this issue.
Doctor, you mentioned how lawmakers need to prioritize these students. That would be one way to at least take a step in the right direction. But with the coronavirus pandemic, we've seen that budgets are stretched as thin as possible and cuts are coming. What's your outlook on that? Is this one of these things where we all have to kind of just wait through this pandemic and hope that the money eventually is there? Or is it just that bleak?
No, there's a lot we can do now. An immediate thing we can do is ask students and listen to what their needs are and ask families. And by asking and listening, I think it becomes much more clear that we have in many instances resources, existing resources that we can bring to young people. So there's a lot we can do now. There's a number of nonprofits like My Friend's Place in the LA area. There are drop-in centers all over Los Angeles, but they're relying on individual donors mostly to support their work. So not only do we need private donations, but we need public investments in this work and this to be a public priority for as many people as possible.
That's Dr. Joseph Bishop, director of the Center for the Transformation of Schools at UCLA and lead author of the report. Doctor, thank you very much.
Thank you, Wei.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and on KPCC.org. I'm E. Martinez. In 2017, California passed the California Values Act, joining a growing list of sanctuary cities and states that aim to bar local law enforcement agencies from using resources on behalf of federal immigration enforcement agencies. While the legislation provided a sense of comfort to immigrant families across the state, it did not guarantee protection from Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. It's an issue that's very personal for 14-year-old Violeta Esquivel. She's a young poet from Monterey Park, and today she was spotlighted during an event called Up Next, America's Young Poets. It was organized by the Berggruen Institute and Second Home Hollywood in collaboration with the local nonprofit Get Lit. The poem she recited there was devoted to threat of climate change. But right now, we want to play for you another work of hers, one that she wrote when she was just 12 years old and performed for KPCC's Unheard LA. It's about her own family's encounter with ICE, and it's called I Faked a Smile.
This is dedicated to mi gente or those who don't understand how immigration affects a child. I faked a smile. Kids do it all the time without being told. They call Los Angeles a sanctuary city. But one day, there was a harsh knock on my door. It pounded and shook our tiny studio apartment. There they were, five or six policemen, green vests, letters ICE stitched across their backs. ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, La Migra, guns and unmarked black cars just like the movies. At the door, they asked for someone else, a different guy, a different name. My mom says, he doesn't live here. We don't know him. Ma'am, can you let us confirm this? They asked in their serious voice. My mom and I held hands, crying in the middle of the street. I never knew how long and deep my street was until this day. At school, we are scared. My friends and I live in fear. How can we learn Common Core when the core of our hearts are breaking? I cannot imagine my life without him. He is my stepfather. I call him Beto. To me, he is el chavo del ocho, el loco, el gordito, el Beethoven, el que se cree el muy, tú sabes. But now he is known as A2057-12204. A stands for alien, belonging to a foreign country or nation, an illegal alien. He was taken away early that morning for an unpaid parking ticket from 2006. No time left, we did not say goodbye. I held back the tears all day and I faked a smile. Now when I visit him, he wears a lime green jumper. My hand is small, his is big. The glass is cold between our hands. When families are torn apart by borders and laws, it hurts. When you take our people away, it hurts. I have a question for you, Mr. President. Una pregunta. In addition to corn, dairy, labor, and música, why can't we start to export education, love, compassion, solutions, educación, amor, soluciones, like a plus sign that adds to, instead of a division line, complicated and long? Why can't the border be a line of love?
The poem you just heard was written over a year ago, but has only recently taken on an entirely new meaning. Here to talk about her work and how poetry can be used as a form of political activism, I'm joined by 14-year-old Violeta Esquivel. Now, Violeta, in many ways, your poetry borders on a unique form of artistic activism. When did you start writing poetry, and what was it about poetry that stood out to you as a way to tell your stories?
I started writing poetry when I was 10 years old, and it first started out with a class assignment that we had. And after my teacher had told me that my writing wouldn't make it anywhere and heavily critiqued my writing, I ended up telling my mom, and my mom told me that she was a published writer back when she was a poet, and she showed me her work. And so she opened me to the world of poetry.
I'm wondering if, okay, so when people listen to your poetry and they see you, they see a kid. I mean, if it's a room full of grown-ups, you're gonna have the idea that all these grown-ups are gonna look at you and they're like, what does this kid know? Or maybe it's gonna be something about flowers or puppies or something, like just something that they would think a kid would write about. And then all of a sudden you hit them with that 1-2 punch, some serious heavy stuff. I mean, do you feel that in some ways is an advantage to get heard for especially the stuff that you are writing about and talking about?
It definitely is. It definitely is 100%. So before I even present my age, I share my knowledge, whether it's my poetry or any other writing that I have. And I share that. And then afterwards is when I present my age. Then I feel like I'm respected on another level and not like a kid.
Do you ever get anyone saying to you, Violeta, you're a kid, you're a teenager, what do you know about these heavy, heavy subjects?
If anyone tells me that I'm a kid and I don't hold knowledge because of my age, as long as I know that I've experienced this and I've educated myself about the situations I've been through, as long as I know that the information that I share comes from me, then I don't think about that. If they think I don't know anything because I'm 14, I can prove them wrong.
Yeah, usually, Violeta, the people that tell you that, grown-ups that tell you that, have not much depth. I want to know, in your poem, I Faked a Smile, you detail a really personal story about your stepfather being detained by ICE officers. Can you tell us a little bit more about why you decided to share this moment and how your personal experience with ICE has shaped the way you view politics around this issue, especially this close to the election?
So this incident with my stepdad and ICE, this happened a year or two before the 2016 election. So I had already been hearing things about the upcoming candidates, Hillary, Trump. And I thought to myself, I was like, why would somebody do this? Why would somebody do this? And then once the situation happened, I didn't know how to deal with it. And it took me a while to find my outlet. And that's when I dealt with it with poetry. But it's something from the movies, I guess you could call it. It's not something you wake up and think, wow, I know my dad is going to be taken away from me at 6:30 in the morning. You don't think about that, you know? And when it happens, it just hits you. And it's crazy, especially for a 9-year-old. This happened to me when I was 9. So for that to happen, that was big and obviously traumatic. And so when I had the chance to write about it and not only do something for my dad, my stepdad, but do something for my community, do something for the Latino community, like that was big. And that was something that I wanted to do. I really took that and went for it.
We're talking to 14-year-old poet and activist Violeta Esquivel. At one point in your poem, Violeta, you describe what it's like to visit your stepfather in the Immigration Detention Center, where he's been for the last year. And I understand that there's been a recent development, actually as recent as yesterday. What's happened?
I have not seen him since November of last year. Like, seeing somebody that you love behind a glass window, it's truly heartbreaking, because you see this person and you know this person is one of the best people in your world. He was there for me for everything, and to see him behind bars, with shackles and security, like, it's truly heartbreaking, because I know he's a good man at heart.
How's his stamina to keep fighting, deportation? Is he and your family still have the energy for this?
It's been a very long battle. It's been a very, very long battle, to the point where some of us, like, there will be times where some of us will be like, we don't know what's gonna happen. Like, do we even have hope at this point? And my stepdad himself, like, he has gotten depressed about it. He said, like, you know what, I don't even think I'm gonna be able to stay. I might as well just take the plea to go back to Mexico.
Is that what he's gonna do? Is he gonna just go back?
That's what he was planning to do as of a couple weeks ago. And it's been very stressful for us, because, you know, like, he's my stepdad and I really, really love him, and like, we're a family, you know. And for us to be broken apart even more, it's heartbreaking.
You know, it's clear at your age, 14, that you are incredibly politically active and aware. However, you're not old enough to vote yet. You still got a few years before that happens. But what do you want people and voters in particular to keep in mind when they go to the polls this election season?
I want voters to know that at the end of the day, it is your choice to vote, whether you are active in politics or not. But just know that voting is very important. Very important. Whether you think that our votes as the public don't count because of the Electoral College, at the end of the day, we dictate what goes on in the government. If we are, everything goes based off of us. So if we put in the effort to change the country, change the way it's being governed right now, change the way things are happening right now. Things could be better. Like, we have the power to make things better. We just need to step it up and take it upon ourselves. If I could, I would vote right now. I would definitely vote right now. But sadly, I can't. But until the decision has been made, I will keep fighting for what's right.
That's 14-year-old poet and activist Violeta Esquivel. Violeta, thanks a lot.
No problem.
If you'd like to hear more of Violeta's poetry and that of the other young poets, please go to berggruen.org/events and look for Up Next, America's Young Poets. We'll also have a link up on our website, taketwo.org.